Okay. Welcome, everybody, to our October business meeting. Just remind everyone that I'd like to take a break about every 90 minutes and to put your cell phones on buzz or turn off the ringer. Before we get started in the agenda, is there anyone that would like to change the agenda or otherwise question anything in the way it's laid out? Motion to adjourn? Second. Okay. We'll get going then. Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple things. The NRCC is meeting in October on the 28th and 29th in Rhode Island. That meeting is primarily to look at both councils, the MID and R, draft priorities, and also to look at ASMFC priorities and the service and science center resources and try to ensure that we have enough resources to meet the management actions for 2009 and beyond. And then we will be approving our priority plan at the November council meeting for management actions for the next management year, 2009. We've got new member training that's now a annual a MSA requirement. Mike Larry, Jim Fair, and Mary Beth will be attending October 21st to 23rd in Silver Spring. And Senator Snow had a hearing scheduled for last week, and it was postponed, and I heard that hearing on Amendment 16 maybe next week, so we're looking into that as well. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Paul? Okay. George Darson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under multi-species, on September 9th, we published a final rule renaming the haddock rope trawl the rural trawl in honor of Captain Phil Rule Sr., who unfortunately was lost at sea in July. Phil was a good friend of the fishing industry and of many of us, and we took this opportunity to honor him in this way. The gear was originally developed under the copyrighted name, the Eliminator. Additionally, we published on September 15th an in-season action approving the rural trawl for general use in the eastern U.S. Canada management area. Regarding the Days at Sea leasing program, from May 1 through October 3rd, 2008, we processed a total of 265 leases. Of those, 254 were approved. The total number of days at sea leased during that period was 7,523.95 at an average cost of day at sea leased of $464.55. We published a final rule on September 10th, 2008, which becomes effective October 10th, implementing Monkfish Framework Adjustment 6. You may recall that action will eliminate the backstop provision that was implemented by Framework Adjustment 4 because the most recent stock assessment information indicated that was no longer necessary. Under scallops, we closed at midnight on October 4th the general category quarter 3 general category scallop fishery based on our projection that the third quarter quota of 623,747 pounds would be harvested. The fourth quarter is scheduled to reopen December 1st, 2008. However, the landings for the second quarter exceeded the quarter two quota by approximately 340,000 pounds, which could be higher or lower after our final investigation of the landings takes place. And those quarter two overages and any overages that may occur in quarter three, although we hope there won't be any, will be deducted from the fourth quarter total allowable TAC. Regarding the status of the limited access general category applications, The application deadline ended August 30th. We've received over 1,200 applications for all categories, with the majority of those being for IFQ scallop permits. On September 10th, we closed the 2008 commercial bluefish fishery in Massachusetts because their quota was attained. And under protected resources, based on a preliminary injunction, we have reinstituted the Dynamic Area Management Program, the DAM program, under the Atlantic Large Whale Take Reduction Plan, and that will be implemented consistent with the previous regulations for that program, except it will only be reinstated north of the pre-existing seasonal area management boundaries, which is north of 4230. Those will remain in effect through April 4th, 2009, and will expire at that time when the broad-based sinking ground line requirement for Atlantic crab pot fisheries is effective on April 5th. We also recently received a petition for listing of the Atlantic wolffish from Conservation Law Foundation. That's a petition for listing under the Endangered Species Act. That petition is under review. Under the ESA, we have 90 days to consider a petition to determine whether the information presented in the petition is substantive and warrants further consideration for a status review. If the determination is that it does, we have 1 year from the date that we received the petition to complete that status review. At the end of that period of time, we either conclude that listing is not warranted at this time and publish a notification of that to that effect, or take the action to list the species and publish a proposed rule to do that. Under Atlantic salmon, we have published a proposed rule to list an expanded Gulf of Maine Atlantic salmon distinct population segment as endangered, and a second proposed rule to designate critical habitat for that expanded population segment. The comment period for the proposed listing closes on December 3rd, and the comment period for the proposed critical habitat designation closes on December 5th. In addition, public hearings are going to be held in Augusta and Bangor, Maine, on November 5th and 6th, respectively. We published a proposed rule in the Federal Register on October 6, 2008 for American lobster that supports the ASMFC's Interstate Fishery Management Plan and responds specifically to the Commission's recommendations for federal action in Addenda 10 and 11 to Amendment 3 of the Interstate Plan. And the comment period on that proposed rule closes on November 20th. And that concludes my report. Thank you.
Thanks, George. I just want to make a comment with respect to the wolffish petition. My recollection is that when we went out to scope for Amendment 16, we scoped for the inclusion of wolffish in the amendment. And after scoping, we were told that essentially, we don't have enough information by which to manage the wolffish by. So I make that comment because over the past few days, I've received some emails and some phone calls that were sort of stating that the council was neglecting its responsibilities or otherwise keeping its head in the sand, which is what we always do. So I just wanted to make it clear on the record that we were trying to do the right thing on this one, and we're told we didn't have enough information. So I mean, I believe that the Data Poor Work Group, which started its meetings Thursday and Friday of last week, and I believe there's two more two-day meetings, is looking into the Atlantic wolffish among other stocks. Any questions for George? Dave Gatham.
Yeah, George, I have three questions, and if you don't have the answers now, maybe we could get them before the end of the meeting. The first is on the VMS system. Apparently, there's a new it's been moved to Silver Springs or something, but people haven't gotten confirmations of sailings and landings now since August 28th. And it's creating a real problem as people try to figure out how many days they've used. I know your enforcement staff is probably getting a lot of calls from fishermen trying to figure out where they are in the system. And I'd like to know something about when that's going to be fixed.
Okay, I think Bill Semrau is going to address your issues in just a few minutes in his report.
Okay, the second one is on the sector histories. I think people were supposed to get them in August, and to my knowledge, they haven't. Nobody's received their histories yet. And I was wondering where that was in the system and when they might get them so they could start verifying them.
That one I'll need to check on.
I received mine, so. So I'm just saying, I think they're going out slowly, so.
I'll have to check with staff, Dave, and
okay, if you could, because we'd just like to know how we'd stand on that. And the last one is on carryover days. I've received a number of phone calls, not a number, two or three, from people that have apparently got issues with carryover days. They've been improperly credited or something. And I'm trying to find out what exactly is happening and what we're doing to fix it. Because, again, people are trying to figure out how many days they get to use. Some of them are pretty well into their days and are getting close to what they think are carryover days, and they can't seem to get a definite answer as to how many carryover days they got, at least on a few permits. I know mine are personal ones have been correct, but these are people who feel they have more carryover days than they've been credited, basically.
Any other questions for George? Okay. Noah, General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've had no significant movement or changes in the four lawsuits in which New England Fishery Management Council is involved in. No developments. I found out yesterday that NIMS was recently sued by the Fishery Survival Fund. I think the petition was filed on October 1st in Federal District Court in Washington, D.C., challenging the reasonable and prudent measures that are included in the sea turtle conservation measure in the biop on the effects of the scallop fishery on sea turtles and in the incidental take statement that accompanied the most recent biological opinion. Specifically, the lawsuit challenges on endangered species ground and Administrative Procedure Act grounds, the measure that limits or restricts fishing in the mid-Atlantic rotational management areas between May and November. And the plaintiffs are seeking to enjoin any implementation or effectiveness of this reasonable and prudent measure in any management measures or other measures that the agency might take that would restrict the scallop fishery. And that concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Gene? Okay. Nancy Thompson. Up. Dave Gatel.
Just a quick one, Gene. On the Framework 42 lawsuit, if there's no, if that's not brought to conclusion before May 1st of 2009, does that become moot? I mean, does it just get thrown out, or does it still continue on?
Well, it doesn't necessarily become moot. It could, at the instigation of either the plaintiffs or defendant in that lawsuit, we could request it. That's actually one of the issues that has been raised by the government in the lawsuit is that it is effectively moot given the developments that are underway now in Amendment 16. So that argument is basically before the court now. We've filed all of the briefs necessary to be filed in that lawsuit and are awaiting the judge's either opinion or setting of a date for an oral hearing before issuing an opinion.
Anything else for Gene? Nancy Thompson?
Actually, Jim Weinberg will give the center's report.
Jim Weinberg.
If Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll start off by, as I usually do, by reviewing the activities of the vessels. The fall bottom trawl survey is underway. It began on September the 2nd, and the Albatross is doing its last fall bottom trawl survey. In fact, it's doing its last survey, period. And it's accompanied by the new vessel, the Bigelow, and they're doing tows in the same locations in order to acquire data for calibration coefficients on the species that we survey. And so the Albatross is going along doing its survey while the Bigelow follows it and accompanies it at certain stations, repeating in the same location at a similar time. And on the bottom trawl survey, so far they've completed all of the stations that are southwest of Nantucket. And they're, I think yesterday, they're starting the third leg, which will be heading northwards on George's Bank. And so they've completed 187 stations so far on the bottom trawl survey. The paired tows between the Bigelow and the Albatross on this cruise so far, they've completed about 150 stations. And I've heard that the paired operation is going very smoothly. They have it worked out quite well to coordinate between the two vessels. So if you combine the number of paired tows that were taken between the two vessels in the spring survey and those that they've taken so far this fall, we're somewhere between 450 and 500 tows. So we're acquiring the data that we need in order to make estimates of the calibrations. For the Delaware, they're involved with a hydroacoustic herring survey. I don't know much more about that, although Dave tells me that he saw the ship off his coast. The scallop cruise was successfully completed aboard the RV Sharp. That's the University of Delaware's UNOLS vessel. And they occupied 491 stations. The data have been audited, and the resource surveys report will be available the week of October the 14th. The Northern Shrimp cruise was completed aboard the Gloria Michelle. They occupied 69 stations, and the data have been audited. The Albatross 4 will be decommissioned on November the 20th in Woods Hole after 46 years of service in the Northwest Atlantic. And now, moving on to some information about stock assessments. We, as you know, at your last meeting, Paul Rago came and spent quite a bit of time reviewing the GARM results. That was the result of a series of meetings that took place in the last 12 months. And the GARM 3 report was basically published on September the 2nd, and that was what Dr. Rago reviewed at your last meeting. We've also been involved with TRACS. These are transboundary meetings for transboundary stocks on Eastern Georges Bank, Cod, and Haddock, and that was last June. And then there were Georges Bank Yellowtail TRAC meetings in August of this year. There will also be TRAC meetings for dogfish. I don't know the exact date, but that's this fall for dogfish data. And then there will be a series of TRAC meetings through the spring and summer on groundfish, dogfish, herring, and mackerel. Now, one of the meetings that was just mentioned is the Data Poor Working Group, and that will be a series of three meetings that are taking place this fall. We had our first meeting last week for 2 days, and then there will be another meeting on November the 3rd to the 7th in Woods Hole, and that'll be basically where most of the analytical work will be done. And then there will be a final peer-reviewed meeting in Woods Hole on the week of December 8th to the 12th. And the stocks that are being looked at are black sea bass, red crab, scup, the skate complex, wolf fish, and weak fish. And the main purpose of that working group is to come up with the best available science on the biological reference points for these stocks. And when it is possible, to also combine that with an update doing a stock status determination. That will be done if possible. The main purpose of the meeting, though, I'd like to emphasize, is to consider the biological reference points and really figure out whether they're the best available given the kind of data that we have, and they have to be things that can be measured. Then we have SARC 48 coming up in June of 2009. That will include either Atlantic surf clam or ocean quahog. We're going to have a little discussion about whether to flip the order of those. And then tilefish and weakfish are also on the agenda for SARC 48. And then this summer, either in July or August, we'll convene a meeting to take all of the vessel calibration data that have been collected and do an analysis of those data and try to come up with the best calibration coefficients that we can for each of the species. And that will be a peer. We'll basically bring in peer reviewers and experts and have a big meeting at the center. And that concludes my report. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Questions for Jim? Okay. Any one of the council liaisons, Mid-Atlantic? Anything to report? Frank?
Yeah, the Mid hasn't met since we've met. Their meeting next week. But if I can, I'd just like to take a couple of seconds here to say that last week that four members from our council, Sally, Rodney, Pat Kirkland, myself, attended the fisheries forum at Stanford, put on by Duke, Stanford, and EDF. And I would advise any council members, if they have another one in the future, I thought it was very worthwhile. And if anybody would like to speak to any of the four of us, it's definitely worth going to. Thank you.
Okay. United States Coast Guard. Rula, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to extend Captain McGinnis's apologies for not being here today. He's at a week-long training session. Commander Marone is still recovering from an illness that kept him out of the office all last week. So Captain McGinnis will be back in November to give the Coast Guard report, the full Coast Guard report. I am in contact with him, and if there's any questions Coast Guard related, I can get back to you all same day. So keep it short.
Okay. Enforcement, VMS. Tim and Jim.
Tim and Bill.
And Bill, sorry.
Yeah, if I could just take a moment, I'd like to just acknowledge that sadly Steve Edwards, who was an economist at the Science Center, passed away after a long fight with cancer. That was last month. And he worked with many of us. We're sorry about that.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Timothy Donovan, Deputy Special Agent in Charge. Andy Cohen, the SAC, was unable to attend, so I will cover enforcement issues this morning. Mr. Chairman, I do apologize that I don't have the hard copy report. It's being printed up for me now. I had to make some corrections, so I'll have it to you around lunchtime. To cover the last quarter for the Northeast Division, we had eight seizures resulting in around $149,000 worth of fish being seized. Additionally, there have been 56 NOVA assessments of approximately $1.5 million for the last quarter. Some of the case highlights were we were actively involved with some joint operations with Mass Environmental Police and the Coast Guard up in Gloucester, a three-day operation that resulted in 33 fishing vessel boardings and 15 federal dealer inspections. A couple of Lacey Act violations were uncovered on that one, as well as one non-permitted federal dealer purchasing lobster, one federal dealer in possession of undersized lobster, and a fishing vessel for non-whale compliant gear. We were also up on Calais, Maine, Port of Entry, working with Customs Border Patrol and Maine Marine Patrol officers for a four-day operation, which resulted in 8 federal cases and 3 joint state cases. The violations included undersized lobster, mutilated lobsters, undersized halibut, undocumented swordfish, and highly migratory species trade permit violations. We recently had one case been referred to the U.S. Attorney's Office for a Massachusetts man with violations of the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act. The incident included striking 2 humpback whales with a vessel, casting tuna jigs over the backs of humpback whales, and disrupting their surface and subsurface feeding behavior. We also had a couple more cases that are pending consideration by the U.S. Attorney's Office regarding whale protection. At that point, I'll be around for the next 2 days to cover any enforcement questions for Andy Cohen. I'll turn it over to Bill Sumrow, and I would also like to introduce John Pinkerton, who is the National VMS Program Manager that's here today as well. That concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Tim, before we make this switch, did you say that there's a case of somebody throwing jigs over the back of a humpback whale?
Yes, the primary reporting of it was the striking of the 2 humpback whales, sir. I could get some additional information if you.
Okay. Bill, sorry.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to invite John Pinkerton.
Well, stick around, Tim. We may have some questions for you. Okay.
Bill. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, council members. Bill Sumrow, Northeast VMS Program Manager, Office of Law Enforcement. And as Tim Sullivan just mentioned, John Pinkerton, to my right, is here with us today. He's the National VMS Program Manager. And later in my brief, I'm going to talk a little bit about the transition to the headquarters data center. And if you have any questions about that, John is here to give you his national perspective. The Northeast VMS team is monitoring 1,316 vessels. By vendor, that's 666 boat tracks, 608 SkyMate, and 42 Tron and Tron. The VMS population is about 167 fewer vessels than my June report, and it's likely attributable to the reduction in the LAGC scallop permits, as well as those surf clam ocean quahog permit holders who gave up their permit rather than maintain a VMS. With regard to software, shortly after the last council meeting, we rolled out the latest VMS software to meet the new requirements of the Amendment 11 to the LAGC scallop FMP. Since SkyMate sends their software CD updates by mail, several owners have yet to install the new software version 3.927. And I just want to use this opportunity to remind them to upgrade to the new software to avoid any enforcement action in the future. With regard to Botrax VMS unit capacity, at the last council meeting, or actually I think it was an earlier council meeting, I mentioned that we reached capacity on a small number of older Botrax units. This means that we can't add any additional lines of declaration or forms text unless we either remove lines or upgrade the units. It's only about 5% of the Botrax fleet, 35 vessels. A work group is addressing the problem. We expect to recommend both short- and long-term solutions to both the Deputy RA and the Deputy Chief of Enforcement by the end of the month. With regard to declaring for every trip, the Northeast VMS team has been reminding owner-operators to declare their activity prior to leaving port for every trip per the Northeast regulations. And vessels that sail without a declaration are being returned to a port to declare their activity and then resail. This action is consistent with OLE's policy to return vessels that miscode their trip. To assist fishermen, a Northeast port listing and description is posted on the VMS webpage on the Northeast Region website. And to ease the burden of reporting through VMS, fishermen may also use the Interactive Voice Response, or IVR, system that allows them to call the IVR to confirm the use of a previous VMS code. This is a handy tool if the intended trip is exactly the same as the last declaration sent to NIMS. Information on this IVR tool is available on our webpage. With regard to the VMS power down exemption request form, there is a new form that passed OMB review, and it's posted on our VMS webpage. The form was revised to include the power down regulatory changes to both the limited access scallop and the surf clam ocean quahog FMPs that allows those vessel owners to turn their units off once they get an exemption if they're going to be at the dock for 30 days or more. With regard to the VMS webpage, I want to remind owners that there is a very good reference document on the webpage that provides you with handy VMS user instructions, and it talks about the power down requirements within those instructions. And finally, and probably most importantly, is the VMS data center transition. This is affecting all OLE divisions nationwide. They are transitioning to the new VMS data center, which is maintained by OLE headquarters. Two data centers for redundancy at Silver Spring and Seattle will standardize and streamline data delivery to NIMS from all VMS vendors nationwide and reduce the number of servers needed to process the data. So my server in the Northeast will be decommissioned. We will transition again to the servers, and we actually have transitioned to the servers at the data center and headquarters. I will mention the transition doesn't change the composition of the VMS team, their monitoring responsibilities, or their customer service to the VMS fleet. We'll continue to do that. VMS vendor data feeds, and I'm talking about position reports and declarations, will now go through the new data center for delivery to the respective OLE divisions, like the Northeast. In conjunction with the data center implementation, the data delivery method for SkyMate and Tron declarations and position reports was changed from SMTP, which is email, to an Internet Protocol or IP gateway. This change should improve timely delivery of data between the vessels and NIMS. Now, it was necessary for the Northeast Division VMS program to transition earlier than planned because the Northeast VMS server had reached its processing limit. However, no VMS data was lost. On September 3rd, the VMS contractor began a backup of the Northeast VMS database and the transitioning of all Northeast unique maps and scripts. The process to move all Northeast specific information and synchronize Northeast VMS with the data center is a considerable and time-consuming effort, and there has been impacts. A VMS message was sent on September 4th, notifying the Northeast fleet of the data center transition. Now, during the transition, the Northeast trip generation script was stopped, which meant that no trips were loaded to the region's Days at Sea database, and no trip notification emails were sent out to the vessels. And I believe this was Dave Gaethel's concern, trip notification emails being trip start, trip landing. Fishermen who typically call OLE for their Days at Sea balance have been told that current information is unavailable until the trip data is loaded into the Days at Sea database. None of these issues affect OLE's ability to track vessels. I know that it's been over a month now since VMS trips were loaded to the region's Days at Sea database. My priority at the moment is to work with both the VMS contractor and the region's Days at Sea staff to complete the remaining actions necessary to load the trips so that current information is available. Presently, the VMS contractor must complete the transfer of historical Northeast data to the data center, and the region must complete the revision of its Days at Sea script that pulls the VMS trips into the Days at Sea database. I do anticipate completion of both of those actions by next week. On the positive side, the Northeast trip generator was restored on September 15th. And to answer Dave Gaethel's earlier question, this action restarted the delivery of automated trip start emails to the fleet. The trip landing emails were delayed due to a script problem, but corrected on October 1st. And Dave, if is it Ellen, Diane, if you're not getting those trip emails, we can talk later. But they were restarted, and the fleet should be receiving those. I won't sugarcoat it, however, the trip emails will continue to stop and restart briefly any time VMS data processing is affected by any scheduled maintenance at the data center or any brief vendor data stalls. And finally, the IVR system feature that allows a fisherman to confirm the use of a previous VMS code that was impacted by the data center transition, but it was restored on October 3rd. And that concludes my comments. And if you have any questions for either myself or John, feel free. We're ready to take those now.
Thanks, Bill. Any questions? Rodney.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for Bill. Will those 5% of the boats be notified that they have to upgrade their VMS units?
Morning, Rodney. Depends on the action we take. One action we could take in the short term is simply to reduce the number of lines of text that is on the VMS screen for all vessels. We have a lot of instructional text in there right now. You know, if you look at some of the forms, cod running clock, differential area layover, we could probably cut down some of that explanatory language. It's been out there for a while now. I think people understand the forms. And we can get out the word in other ways, you know, through permit holder letters explaining those forms in detail. So that's a short-term fix. If it requires in the long term to upgrade those units, yes, most definitely they will be notified.
Thank you.
And at this point, we're not sure whether it would be at a cost borne by the owner or whether there might be another way to go, such as the reimbursement program. But right now, I can't say which way that's, you know, how that's going to be resolved.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah. Thanks for your report, Bill. People who don't know, I communicate with Bill on a fairly regular basis about VMS issues. I did want to say for the record that his staff has been unfailingly friendly. I have my wife call a lot because I'm at sea. But I never identify myself as a council member or anything. I just want to see how the general public is treated. And they are treated, in my experience, with a great deal of courteousness, and people really do try to get the answers to the questions that are raised by the seemingly continuous rebuilding of the VMS system. As to the trip starts and stops have started coming in October, albeit in spurts. They, you know, I think I got two or three the other day in a matter of hours, but I didn't get any for, you know, 3 or 4 days. But they are coming, and they seem to be right. I know we had a discussion about the email you sent out on September 4th, and you were going to look into that. And the issue is that if you get an email, and if you remember, we had a council meeting September 3rd and 4th, so my boat was just sitting there. And if the email comes in and the computer's not on, it only sits on there for a certain amount of time, and then it vanishes. So I never got that email. And anybody who's not fishing on a daily basis doesn't get all those emails. And if anything you were going to look into seeing if you could make them either go to the people's home, if they give you a backup email or something, has anything been done about that?
Right. We did talk about that, and that's something I am looking into. As you know, owner-operators can give us a secondary email address, internet address, that we could send email there. And I'm looking for a way to develop a distribution list so that those kinds of fleet-wide VMS messages could go to the secondary addresses. I haven't cracked that nut yet, but I'm looking at that.
I hope you can. That would be a really good idea. I mean, then we'd at least get the messages. And I mean, for myself, the trip starts and ends, I get far more of them at home than I get on the boat, because sometimes I'm not on the boat for over 24 hours. So if they're on there, they just vanish. If I didn't have the list at home, I'd probably never be able to keep up. But for Mr. Pinkerton, I was just curious if you could tell us from the Washington perspective, you know, how much longer you think it's going to be on your end before everything is more or less squared away here and we can start getting this stuff on a regular basis.
To directly answer the question, I believe that we are in the final phases of it this week, and things will get back to somewhat of a normal basis. If I can explain just a little bit what has actually happened. On about September 2nd, what actually occurred was a catastrophic failure of the infrastructure that's in the Northeast office. And we gathered all the contractors that are associated with the program together to determine what we need to do at that point. And decision was made to switch the Northeast system into the data center because of the fact that if we could realign the Northeast system, there was no guarantee it was going to stay online. So decision was made to move them into the data center. I will say that an orderly transition, a planned transition from the region to the data center takes about 45 days. What has happened here is we've tried to do an unplanned transition, and we've hit several bumps in the road, to be actually honest with you, because of the complexity of the Northeast management system. However, I think that we have resolved many of the issues, and I think that we're going to be back on track on a normalized basis on this week. It's been difficult. However, I will say that the gains are going to far outweigh the issues we've had. For instance, the data centers were built around the idea of preventing this type of failure from occurring, where before you had one server operating and processing your data, now you have 10 servers operating, processing, and data on both coasts. The information is maintained in the cloud. What I mean by that is virtually maintained so that it can be accessed by any of our personnel at any time, 24 hours a day. We are not subject to weather closures. We're not subject to various types of communications outages because we have taken redundant pathways to the data centers where your data actually travels over three different routes and three different last miles, if you will, meaning that the basic data outages that you had in the past are just that, in the past. The system is far more robust and far more capable than anything that has preceded it. So the gains as we move forward are going to far outweigh the pain that we're suffering right now. It is an unfortunate event that we end up having to force the change instead of going through our orderly process that we had planned, which would have allowed us to test and to ensure that things weren't disrupted as we went along.
Just one last question, and I you may not even want to answer this one, but are the VMS vendors cooperating here? I deal with one particular vendor, and I'm in the study fleet, which sends a whole separate stream of data outside of enforcement, a separate VMS. And what I see, at least with the vendor I have, is two things they say whenever there's a problem. First of all, there's no problem. And second of all, if there is a problem, it must be on your boat. It can't be in our system. And from our experience, there is always a problem, and the problem is usually with the VMS vendor. It is not on the boat. So is this endemic to these people, or is it just this one particular vendor?
Somewhat of a loaded question. We get that from a couple of the vendors, and we are taking steps. Part of the whole data center plan, our five-year plan, which we're in year three of that plan right now, is to try to get those type of things under control. With the data center systems, we're actually able to track back and trace problems a lot faster and with a lot more accuracy than we had before, than we could before. So we're looking at the issue of when outages occur, whether they affect a single vessel or whether they affect multiple vessels, and it appears to be a vendor-related outage, how we can get those things handled on a more timely basis and get information out to the fleet on a more timely basis. Because I think that that is probably the largest issue of all, is the fact that not that problems occur, but that so many people are left in the dark when these problems occur. So we are trying to we have built an infrastructure that actually helps us troubleshoot back through the vendor systems and also to notify the fleet when problems do occur so that everyone will know what's going on. We may not be able to move it faster, but at least we'll all be on the same page when things happen.
Thank you. That will be immensely helpful if they just acknowledge that there's a problem and we're trying to fix it. It would be make life so much simpler so that I'm not communicating with Bill, or I'm actually communicating with my wife who's sitting in the back of the room who's then communicating with Bill or the vendor. I mean, it's just back and forth, and it's getting really, really frustrating to have these people continuously say it's not, you know, they seem to, it's like they sent them to a school and they have two phrases. One is, we never heard of that problem before, and second of all, it's not our fault. And it is, you know, from the people at the, you know, rank and file level here, it's getting pretty frustrating to have to deal with this at that level. So I'm glad you're working on it.
There's one other piece I'd like to add to that. We may have caused a little bit of this problem because we maintain statistics on the vendors, and we actually call them on the carpet based on their customer service and on their the outages they actually incur over time. If they seem to exceed the norm, we call them in and basically tell them they have to straighten out. So vendors, many of the vendors, especially one particular vendor, is very sensitive to it, and that's probably why you get some of these things. But like I said, we are working to try to make this more seamless and ensure that the customer service is there. We take it very seriously, and we have had several meetings and agreements with the vendors to ensure these things didn't happen. In-house, we take it seriously as well. We have, to put it plainly, we've removed employees from the VMS system that have not been responsive to the fleet and not taken seriously the needs of the fishers in the field. So we take these matters very, very seriously.
Anything further? Okay. Thank you very much. Atlantic States. Vince.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. The commission met in August 19th and 21st in Alexandria, Virginia, and there was a report of that meeting that was in your council meeting book at your last meeting, so I'm not going to cover that. Some of you, particularly from Rhode Island, might be aware that the Rhode Island Fishermen's Alliance had brought a suit against Dr. Sullivan from Rhode Island DEM regarding the Commission's Amendment 3, Addendum 7 to the Lobster Plan. And the issue there was moving towards trap tag allocations and limiting the number of participants in the lobster fishery. The Commission joined as interveners and defendants, and that case, originally brought in state court, was removed to Rhode Island federal court. The plaintiffs made a number of arguments. One was that efforts to limit effort in a commercial fishery or limit participants in a commercial fishery in Rhode Island violated the Rhode Island Constitution. And these individuals were being denied their constitutional rights. It's an argument we've seen before at the Commission, both in discussion of plans as well as previous lawsuits. The Rhode Island Lobstermen's Association, interestingly enough, also joined as interveners and defendants. On Friday, last Friday, Judge Lisi in Providence granted the defendant's motion for summary judgment to dismiss the case. And one of the interesting things in her decision was that the ASMFC provision that allows states to develop conservation equivalency or alternate plans to measures doesn't relieve the states of complying with the plan. It doesn't make the plan optional. She also noted that the plaintiffs didn't submit a plan of their own. It's a good case both for Rhode Island DEM and for the commission. I have a copy of the case on my computer, and if folks here would like me to email it to them, I'll be here for the next 2 days, Mr. Chairman. I'll be happy to send it. And if you wanted to look it up, it would be Rhode Island Fishermen's Alliance versus Michael J. Sullivan, and probably et al. Now. And then the third item, Mr. Chairman, is the Commission's annual meeting is later this month, October 20th through the 23rd. And since it's our annual meeting, the venue changes, and this year we're in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. The agenda is posted on the website, and I also have a copy here with me if folks had a particular question about a management board when it's meeting. All our meetings are open to the public, and certainly everybody's welcome. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman, other than thank you for your hospitality. It's good to be back. Thank you.
Thanks, Vince. Any questions for Vince? Okay. We're going to move into the next agenda item, which is an open period for public comment. This is a period at every council meeting that we